This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
All right, thank you. Before we move to our last panel, I just want to share a few words. First of all, a confession. I'm standing out here, out from behind the podium, because you may have detected I'm not comfortable behind a podium. That's not the space I usually work in, even though I'm an academic. I work in communities. I work with people. When I teach, I don't stand behind a podium. It makes me deeply uncomfortable. So here I am, more in your face, and that's where I'd like to be. So because I want to tell you a little bit about the Walter H. Capp Center and what we're doing today. I don't want to distract from the main point of the celebration, which is Walter Capps himself and his legacy in all the domains we've talked about. But the center participates in that legacy and is moving it forward. So I just want to share a little bit with you about what we've been doing and what you can expect from us going forward. Second confession, I've never felt all that great about having been born in Omaha, Nebraska. Because my parents moved the family to Colorado when I was 2 weeks old, and I've been proud of that ever since. People ask me, where are you from? Colorado. My two kids are in the back, two of them. They'll call me out. They say, Dad, are you sure? Look at your driver's license. It says Omaha, Nebraska. I'm like, oh, man, no, you don't have to say that. But then I begin to think, wait a minute. Walter Capps, Bob Carey, Malcolm X. Maybe not such a bad place after all. And so one thing I've taken away from these last 2 days is, damn it, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, and I'm proud of that. So thank you very much. This conference has been really great for me for selfish reasons. As the person charged with carrying forward the mandate of the CAP Center, I've worked with the handicap of only knowing him on paper. And I've looked through a lot of papers and some video, but really didn't have a flesh and blood sense of who he is. And I still don't have that, of course, but I have the next best thing, which is your memories of him. The last 2 days, I've just learned so much about community, about responsibility, reciprocity, just who he was as a person. So long as I continue to direct the center, that will inform what I do. And so this has been an invaluable gift. I want to thank everyone who's participated. I now know Walter Capps and his vision so much better than I did before. A few things that we do at the center that I'm really proud of, and we're perpetuating what Clark Roof had done for so many years so well, and others with him, Noni Hamilton, Greg Jarrett, and others who've worked at the center longer than I have. We continue in that great work. We teach classes on ethics. Katya Armistead talked about the civic engagement class. Noni Hamilton does a fabulous job with our undergraduate McCune internship program. We have a graduate fellowship program, the Mendel Fellowship. So all this continues apace. It's fantastic work. Look for our students in the community. We're so proud of what they do. Programming, we continue the tradition of what I'd like to think is fantastic programming. Sometimes one-off events, sometimes more iterative events. We did a whole year on Native American sacred spaces, for example, so building themes. But what I'm most excited about is the next step beyond that. How do we take that back to the community? One-off events aren't enough. How do we persuade people that we're actually doing something in their communities? We're only taking baby steps at this point, but they're going to become bigger steps. One project we have is on the east side of the Sierra Nevada. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. And I'm actually working with one of Alessandro Durante's prize PhD students, Justin Richland, on this. We're working with some of the Paiute tribes in their conversations with the federal government about wildland fire management. You might be thinking, what does that have to do with the CAP Center? I don't know the first thing about fire other than it burns and burns things up. But what I do know is it ignores jurisdictions. And so when fires come bear down on Bishop, Mammoth, these places, they're also at that same time bearing down on Native peoples. So how do those peoples get out front of these issues, work with the federal government in a way that's something more robust than mere consultation? That's the insulting standard the federal government usually hews to. So this is a project about, say, what's the next step in making this process more human, more engaged, more full-throated for Native peoples? We don't fashion that we can change this overnight or maybe at all, but we can help convene conversations about it, and that to my mind, is exactly, as I've learned the last few days, what Walter would have done. Sit people down and say, what are we talking about? How can we have this conversation? Why are we here? A similar project in Hawaii is about implementing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples there, just working with local communities. What are their interests? How do they use this international mechanism to speak back to state and federal entities about their interests? Again, it's about conversations, about community-level learning. You can expect more along these lines. Associate Director Dusty Hosley, who's so instrumental to putting on this very conference, I want to say, he's put together a grant with the Luce Foundation, and this is about Asian American religious freedom. This is also an iterative project that's been ongoing for the last year and will continue. So again, the point is, yes, we do programming. Please come. We'll be doing more in the community, but also look to our follow-on projects. That's what we're really invested in right now. How do we make good on Walter's promise that these conversations can continue to happen in communities? I invite you to reach out to me with ideas about programming and projects. So I'm easily reached through the CAP Center, but I'm also just gjohnson@ucsb.edu, easy to find. We're very receptive to ideas you may have. What matters here in this community? How might we address it? We want to know, and I'm a newcomer. I can't presume to know what the issues are, but I'd love to hear from you. Okay. I could say more, but I'll stop there. I just wanted you to have a sense where we're headed. Oh, well, one thing I should mention. Our next event is in January. Kiara Bridges will be visiting us. She's a professor at Berkeley Law, and she's an expert on the intersection of critical race theory and reproductive justice. The Legal Humanities Initiative and the Health Humanities Initiative are working together with us to sponsor this important talk. Please come out. If you've ever seen her speak, you'll know. It won't be forgettable. And so we invite you. This is January 19th. It'll be posted on our website and so forth. Okay, now back to the program you were promised. I would like to call to the stage someone who's become a friend, but who is nonetheless my boss, and who is a convener of conversations himself. And I would give you a longer introduction, the one he deserves, except that you all know him, Chancellor Henry Yang.
Thank you. Good afternoon. And it is such an honor and a pleasure to be here today to celebrate and commemorate the life and the legacy of Walter Capps and the many ways in which he contributed to the higher education and the public service. I would first like to thank our colleagues of CAP Center for putting together this wonderful, wonderful two-day program. So well done, so meaningful, thank you. And especially thanks to our director, Greg Johnson. Greg, thank you. Thank you for your leadership. And also, of course, I also like to give a very special warm welcome to the CAPS family, the wonderful CAPS family. Bringing my memory back to 1994, I remember Dylan and I first time visited campus. Before we visited campus, and the UCOP president, Jack Pelterson, told me, he said, well, Henry, you ought to take a look at the campus before you go there. So we came on a day in April of 1994. So we came. And he said that, remember, UC Santa Barbara is very well known in the country, just like Princeton University, for three things, one in the east, one in the west. I said, what are the three things? He said, first, each one has a wonderful, wonderful top religious studies program. Another is they also are very good in theoretical physics. And another third thing is they don't have a medical school. That's why the secret formula of excellence, that's what he said. So we came here, we met Walter. Of course, I was very anxious to meet our religious studies famous professors. At that time, you remember the young faculty, Richard Hecht, and the Ninian Smart, Robert Michelson. I can go on for a dozen of lists. Lois, you probably can remember those names, those people. And when I talked to Walter, and we had a deep conversation, he had one thing in mind, I had one thing in mind. What I had in mind is asking for his advice, how can we stop that project called a Clearview Project? They want to build a 175-foot tower on campus, you know, slant drill the oil. You can see our campus just could not accept that. And then he was talking to me about, he was pondering about running for the Congress. So we had some conversation. Then after that, we went back to where we came from, Indiana, and we started to understand about his course, his classes on the Vietnam War, religious and the impact of Vietnam, and the voices of the stranger were some of the most popular in the history of our campus. I remember on a Sunday, I just couldn't believe, you know, in the cornfield in Indiana, you turn on the television, A&E channel, here's Walter Capps was giving his Vietnam course. That's nationally televised. I mean, very seldom our courses can be nationally televised. Dylan and I, that Sunday, I remember we had a Sunday brunch and just watching for that. Also, of course, later on the following month, it was on the 60 Minutes about his Vietnam course. So when I came here, I had a lot of conversation about this course. He said, Henry, why don't you come to my class to give a lecture one time? It was in this very hall, filled with 700 people, I remember. So during that time after the class, I asked a student who was a veteran. I said, do you think, what are the chances of Walter running for the Congress? He told me, he said, well, he could heal the wounds of Vietnam veteran. He sure can heal the wound of the country. I think he'll have no problem getting elected. So from there on, I told Walter, I said, it's going to be a smooth sail. So of course he was elected. When he first elected, he told me, he said, Henry, I'm going to be serve on the science committee. So when he served on the science committee, I couldn't believe it. Our research grant just coming in. The UCSB had a very beautiful 2 years after that. And those physicists, the engineers, just think the world of him during the time. I can just keep telling you my experience with Walter. And Walter was, you know, here on our campus, he has shared his inspiring vision and creating the center where our students, faculty, and the public could all discuss issues to define our humanity, including religion, war and peace, ethics, public life. And now, happened on October 7th, the thing most needed on our campus is public discourse. I think CAP Center is a perfect place to do public discourse. And so we've got the work cut out for us. And our EVC is here, you are here, and we are all committed. I guess the rest you all know, I probably don't need to say much, but I just miss Walter so much. In my life, every time when I close my eyes, I can remember that evening, Lois, you and me and a lot of volunteers and family members at Port Hueneme, waiting for his jumbo aircraft carrier from the Air Force landed, and he was honored and wrapped by the star, you know, American flag, and we were waiting for him till 2 a.m. I still remember that. I miss him tremendously, but our campus is enormous, proud, and honored to have Walter to be our faculty member, and ever since the second year when it was founded 30 years ago. And the next year we'll celebrate 60 years, the diamond celebration of the Religious Studies Department. Now, without further ado, let me have the honor to introduce our panel today, the Honorable Bob Carey, I always remember the day you walked into my office with Walter in 1994. I think we all know you, so you need no introduction. And also the Honorable Lois Capps, and the Supervisor Laura Capps, and our alumni community advocate Todd Capps, and the journalist, author, and a biographer Lou Cannon. Lou, so nice to welcome here. I always remember the first day I came to campus, you give me the advice. You say, remember, always return the call. Return the phone call. Whoever called you, always return the call. Now I remember I advise everyone, return the email. Thank you.
We just heard our older sister talk for the first time in 20 years. This has been a pretty heavy couple of days. So my therapist wife would say we need to check in, right? This is how I check in. I'm gonna go first, and I need your help. Deo!
Deo!
One more time. Deo!
Deo!
I think we're ready.
All right, Todd, awesome. Thanks to my big brother for that. Hi, everyone. Thanks for so many of you who've been through the whole program here, and some who've just joined us, and our family in Portland and the Bay Area that are watching and elsewhere. I think my brother and my mom would agree that this is overwhelming for us in a good way, in a really good way, and I look forward to kind of unpacking in the days and weeks and months and years to come. So thanks to the CAP Center. Thanks to all of you who came, to so many of our speakers, to our chancellor, who literally was there the night that my mom and I were with the casket as it came. We came across the country completely shell-shocked and landed, as he said, in Point Hueneme. And it's 2 a.m, and there's Chancellor Yang waiting for us as we entered a new chapter of our lives. And so we're going to have a free-flowing conversation here, but I did have some questions that I'll help kick us off. And I'm definitely no scholar, but I was a history major, and so I just want to set a couple dates out for context here, because we're sitting with the person who, if our dad had a light about this transition from academics to public life, to politics, the gentleman here, the Navy SEAL, the Medal of Honor winner, the United States Senator, the governor, he definitely lit that spark faster than it would have been lit otherwise. And so when the CAP Center came to us with this wonderful idea to do this this symposium, the first thought is, oh, I wonder if Bob Kerry would come. And sure enough, he said yes, and he's here. And it's great for us to have him. It's a true, true honor. So our task with this panel is to talk a bit about that transition that you saw so beautifully documented through video that we haven't seen before to much degree from Professor Durante, of the academic to the politician. And what did that mean for him? What was his role in public life? What is the role of public life now in such a confusing time? So, and we're just going to talk a little bit here, and then I do want to turn it over to some questions or comments, because what's been so powerful for me over the last day and a half is just what's come out of those who've chosen to come here. So thank you so much. So some dates are that our parents met in 1957. They married in 1960. Todd, our first Lisa was born in 1964, then Todd in 66. Me in 72. I just give these dates because they frame somewhat this conversation. Senator Kerry was governor first from 1983 to 1987. Somehow during that time, I think it was 1986 perhaps, our dad wormed his way into the Capitol in Nebraska and met the then governor and invited him to his class, and then he came. I remember it was a big day with all the accoutrements of a governor coming to a small town like this. And from that led a wonderful friendship that, as I want to ask him about, led to him co-teaching the class in between his service as governor and senator from Nebraska. But I'm going to start with you, Mom, as I should appropriately, the person who's known our dad the longest, because clearly this theme of public service was something that Walter Capps was destined into, and it took different forms and it evolved. And this is in conversation with you. How did you see that, if you could kick us off, how did you see that approach evolve over time? What, like his notion of public service, where that come from? He was first generation college. What didn't necessarily come from his parents, but where did how did that evolve from academics to politics? And how did you, how was your, from your catbird seat, how did you see that evolution?
Is this on?
There we go. There you go.
Thank you, Laura. And it's so fitting that we're in this space to do this today. Many of you have made note of that already. But you asked me a question. And I have to go back to a tiny bit of biography of Walter in Omaha. Growing up in a Swedish Lutheran community, part of the community, it was sort of preordained that he was going to go on somehow and become a Lutheran preacher. But he had a kind of a jumbled undergraduate career out in the Northwest. Well, between the Midwest and the Northwest. And it included, by chance almost, a introduction to philosophy at an ordinary community college in Portland, Portland State. Even before it was Portland State University, it was Portland State College. And it unlocked something in him. Because he went on to the seminary, we met around that time, so I don't know all of the details, but he got an opportunity in his last year at the seminary to get a scholarship to Yale University Divinity School for a master's. Because he realized, I think, during that time, and maybe some other people realized as well, that he could think. And maybe could do well in academics. So we spent 4 years, that was the beginning of our marriage, in New Haven, Connecticut. And then, as some of you might be graduate students, there comes a time in those days, 1964, when postings for job openings in the fall would be on the bulletin board in the graduate hall. And Walt came home one day so excited. He said, "There is an opening for a professor of religious studies at the University of California in Santa Barbara. I want to go. I want to apply." Now, his classmates thought he was a little crazy. Santa Barbara? Where's that? That's, isn't that out there somewhere in California where people go to retire? Or maybe they grow lemons or something like that? Anyway, the topic was brought up yesterday by David Marshall, thankfully, that this campus has the distinction of the first campus of the United, taxpayer-supported institution that would offer a course in religious studies. And Walter was the second person hired. The idea for having a department came out of the sociology or political science department, one of those, David said. And so we came from graduate school. I was 7 months pregnant with Lisa, with a U-Haul trailer behind our old pink Buick down over Siskiyou Pass into this little town first Goleta and then downtown Santa Barbara, and here we were. And he opened up shop in one of the barracks in his office, and the department and joined the faculty. His dream had come true of being able to teach about religion, teach religious studies in a secular setting. And the rest is pretty much history.
Can I add a little thing? I love the story. As I hear it, they arrived, first shopping trip was to Santa Cruz Market, which is not far from here in Old Town Goleta. And coming from a Norwegian heritage, mom sees this entire rack of flour tortillas and says, "My gosh, there must be a huge Norwegian community here. Look at all this lefse."
If you've been to Solvang, you know what that is. I had never seen a flour tortilla. I've seen a few since.
So we have, I'm reminded, we have a lot of good public servants in the audience. We have our former state senator, Hannah Beth Jackson. We have political esteemed journalists, Luke Cannon and Jeff Greenfield, who know a heck of a lot about people running for office. But this notion of a professor running for office is pretty unusual. I realize, Senator, that you did it the opposite way. You were in politics and public life and then went to academia. And I just wonder if you saw, when you met our dad, any notions or any memories you have of this, of a potential budding politician in your midst?
No.
No.
Short answer.
Well,
he said no, just in case you didn't hear that.
Okay. No, I didn't. I mean, it's one of these people that, on the other hand, that after you get to know them a little bit, you might say, God, I wish we had people like that running as candidates, but I honestly never thought that he would be that stupid. really, because it's, you know, he's living in paradise out here, and it's 3,000 miles to Washington, D.C., and it's a big price for someone like Walter. He was giving up I would never have asked him to do it, but I was very happy that he did. And it was a tough year. I ran for re-election in 94, and, you know, we lost the majority, we lost Ann Richards, we lost a lot. We Democrats lost a lot that year. So he was flying hard into the wind.
Yeah. And the notion of second thoughts, we all experienced, there were many second thoughts, and my Uncle Doug, who ran his campaign in 96. I mean, it wasn't, I know he gave a good answer to Jeff Greenfield when asked that question when he was here covering the race in 1996. And I believe it was a true answer that he wanted to be part of this realization of what our framers envisioned, but it wasn't an easy one. And I was just wondering, Todd or Mom, do you have, I mean, you probably have much to say, but just sort of the seeds that came sort of in the 90s maybe before. It was interesting to see Lisa. I didn't know that she would answer so emphatically that she thought he
either.
Always had it in him or had it in him for a long time. I would not have expected that answer.
Not at all. Did you? Mom, I didn't know that, well, it's trying to digest, you know, just hearing her voice for the first time in a long time, but her answer reminded me that I think we did have a lot of conversation in our family about his back and forth and reluctance and hesitation, and I think, I think the impulse made sense. I think that a lot of the themes that were discussed in his courses, and we could talk about this maybe a little bit later, further in the conversation, you know, what is that thread, what is that kernel that ties his vision as an academic, as a scholar, to what he saw as an opportunity as a representative in Congress. But I think there was a constant tension there with him trying to decide if it would work, if it would plug in an effective way. And then also just kind of the realities of the job, not wondering if he, you know, not sure if he wanted to take on that world in that way.
I'll offer that when he did get there, I came as his spouse. But I remember him sitting in the chamber, a house chamber, after votes, where it was all quiet. And he said, he just sat in the chair, just looked up at all what the room was and what it stood for and who'd been there. And he exulted that he was there, not proud, not in a prideful way, but that he could be part of this experiment of democracy, born in conversation, as you said, Sandro. And he did believe when he said words like building, rebuilding the trust between people. And he did believe that we do have more in common as human beings than that which divides us. And that came through, I think a lot of it came out of the class in Vietnam. There was such a rapport between students and the Vietnam veterans, a healing process that literally took place in this space. It's sacred space. It was then, mm-hmm. when those relationships developed. And at the time, he went a couple times with students back to the wall, the memorial to the Vietnam War after it had been built. And the students would go, and some of them wanted to go to see their representative, who I won't mention names at that time. It was before his opponent's time. And they didn't know where the member of Congress had kind of gone AWOL. And it would reinforce, you've got to take this stuff seriously. It was really a big deal. And he saw it, I believe, back to the original question on public service, he saw it as an extension of his, what he believed to be a calling to the classroom. But he never was content with the classroom, as many of you who were his students knew. He would love the fact that there are interns out in the community now who are doing this as students, because he would open the windows, he'd open the doors, He invited the veterans in to teach. He'd be uncomfortable with 2-day seminar on Walter Capps. He'd be looking down at his shoes, wouldn't he? Because he was focused on the stories that needed to be told, that people needed to be able to share.
Yeah.
Well, look, in the event that nobody says it, he might have won re-election, I don't know. But the fact that you won 19 terms to the House of Representatives. Nine terms. Yeah. Well,
old, but not that old.
Yeah, 9 terms to the House of Representatives is, and you can see it now when you're talking. You did a remarkable job, both restoring that trust with the voters of the 21st, I don't want to get my numbers wrong again. But with other people in Congress who knew who you were and what you were doing, people trusted you, and it didn't come accidentally.
Well, we have Senator Kerry to thank in part for that, because you did come out and co-teach this class, and then, as you explained earlier, there was the death of the senior senator in Nebraska, which meant you had a decision to make, and you entered back into politics. And that led to a presidential run that our dad was happy to join a bit on the campaign trail. But I do think that that's really what lit the match of something that had been apparently brewing, but gave him this real push, this kick. Okay, if not, I better do this. And then the opening, as you know, there's so much luck that goes into all these things, right? The fact that there was an open seat in 1994, which makes it much more plausible that someone who'd never run for office before could run for Congress. But it really, you know, I mean, I just wonder if you, I know you kind of were kind about like coming out, you came out here to teach a class because it was a good time of year to be here. But can you talk a little bit about that time of of your reflection as someone who was thick into public service and then took a bit of a reprieve into academic life?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's much more likely the road was flowing in the other direction. I mean, I don't think I can get Walter in trouble today, and I don't think I can get myself in trouble today by saying we spend a lot more time talking about things other than his class. So, and a lot of it did have to do with national politics and what's going on in the country and what's going on in the world. You don't learn much from an introduction, and what you don't know about me is most of the big decisions I made in my life have been connected to serendipity. I didn't volunteer for United States Navy SEAL team. I was about to be drafted from the Army, been in the Army. I just read the Kane Mutiny and volunteered for the Navy. And there's many more decisions just like it. I just ran for governor because of four or five fiscal problems. I served 4 years and did a press conference one morning without telling anybody and announced I wasn't going to run again. And then in comes this bunny. That's the that's what they call the kids that went to his high school in Omaha Benson. They were the Benson Bunnies. The bunny comes in and says, would you co-teach a class with me in the winter quarter at the University of California, Santa Barbara? So I'm sitting there, 43 years old, single, and I have to decide, do I want to spend January, February, March in Santa Barbara, or January, February? I wasn't even like, oh, God, that's great. Let's do this class on Vietnam. It was a terrific place to go, and I don't think I would have run for Senate had I not done that, in part because I needed a break, but in part because your dad. The comment says, so it's much more likely, and who can say for certain, it's much more likely to say that I ran for Senate because of your father, rather than he ran for the House because of me.
Wow.
That's life.
That's life. Yeah.
I'm Todd, what about you? Did you see what kind of inclinations or not, the lack of inclinations or?
I think that impulse to want to take what he was doing. I think of, there's a lot of talk about what's sort of the kernel of dad, and being, if you were to sort of dig beneath the layers of politics and academics and scholarship. And we sort of had this exercise in the Common Table Foundation that led to these events, trying to define what that kernel is. I think when I was doing some research 7 or 8 years ago, as we were getting ready to put together this program of Common Table events, I found a notepad of his with the phrase, realizing our connectedness. And it was underlined twice. It jumped off the page, and I thought, realize is a really interesting word. It can mean recognize, but it can also mean the proactive manifest. And I thought, well, that's the nugget. And I think he hoped, at least, that he could create some kind of authentic connection between people that is of value in the same through the simple process of getting to know each other, telling each other, sharing our stories. And that if we could do that in some way that could reflect the success of how that was achieved in his courses on the national stage. And I think that's also how he saw, to me, the idea of public service was largely for him about in getting people to kind of get to know each other. And I know that sounds really simple, but I think when you look at how that step is so often skipped, we jump right to level 37 or 38, where to these contentious fringes of a topic where it's already, heels are dug in. I think he realized that if we could start at that fundamental, he was inspired by people, Parker J. Palmer, and who said, before you debate someone, spend 5 minutes getting to know their story, you'll still likely see them as an opponent ideologically, but you will no longer be able to see them as an enemy. And so I think that it was those kinds of impulses that drove in a very broad stroke way, his desire to enter that arena, but I don't think it was based on him being, you know, like a policy wonk or anything like that. I think it was a much more general vision.
Eli yeah. said, if Kerry could do it, I could do it. That's all, you know, I may have set the bar pretty low for him.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. But yeah, no, I agree. I mean, having seen him on the campaign trail kind of resist those extremes that, as a candidate, the media or the folks want you to jump towards. I remember him sort of taking, you know, having fun with it, you know, when people say, what's your position on water? You know, oh, I'm for it. We all need water, you know, because it's just kind of the absurdity of these. You have to be for or against, you have to say yay or nay, you can't, you know, the lack of discourse that you are just is natural as an academic, and then you get buttonholed. And he just, I think, if anything, if he had a longer tenure, would have made more strides to improve that kind of discourse, not for the entire body mm-hmm. of Congress, but in the at least in the interactions that he had. And we can attest. I mean, I was in Washington the short time that he was there, and he was head over heels happy, which is makes me feel good knowing how things ended with such a sudden heart attack. That he wasn't stressed or unhappy or unhealthy. He was kind of, you know, he was riding high. And I do have this memory I wanted to share of the State of the Union that year that he passed. I was just in a wonderful position of having helped President Clinton with that speech amongst, you know, a team of 15 or so, but having worked on that speech in the gallery, and you're up there in the, with the other partners, and I'm there with the speechwriting staff, and he was there as the new member of Congress, and he was just
seventh heaven.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.